Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, April 4th, 2017. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me at the table this afternoon, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good afternoon.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good afternoon.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Before the committee, we have two bills that have been previously heard. We were doing a sectional walkthrough of Senate Bill number 6, the CS for Senate Bill number 6 from Judiciary Version E. The public hearing was opened and closed this morning. We had four folks testify as well as questions answered by a variety of people. Mr. Witt, if we could have you join us at the microphone. We had just concluded a discussion on page 4 of the bill, line 14, that talked about reconditioning. And we were talking about how marijuana plants with different THC content looks very similar. And there was talk of location of how close the plants were located to each other, as well as how the department would go about reviewing some of those crops. On page 4, line 19, Mr. Witt, under number 2, it says maintain records, I believe is what it's referring to, for at least 3 years following the sale of a transaction of industrial hemp. And I'm wondering why 3 years was chosen. And the reason I wonder that is the federal government, when you submit tax returns or otherwise, typically have a 5 or 10 year life that they do a look back on, and I'm wondering whether 3 years is long enough or whether if there's a reason why we're choosing 3 years and if that will hurt the potential grower if they look at state record and it's not consistent with federal records. Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Shelley Hughes. Yes, Madam Chair, we've been asked this question before. I would answer it in two parts. First, it's modeled after other hemp programs in other states that have put this type of language in. And the second part of that is, as you mentioned, it's not uncommon for businesses to keep records, retain records for a specific amount of time. The bill sponsor certainly isn't married to that particular length of time to retain the records, but we do believe that for the public trust specifically, it's important to keep the records for some length of time. In case there are questions regarding the transfer or sales of industrial hemp from a farmer to a producer, someone who's making it into something else. But again, we thought 3 years was a good timeline. It would ensure that there is some level of oversight from the Division of Agriculture to go in and check records. We thought after 3 years, it really would have outlived its usefulness as far as retention of records. But again, Madam Chair, that's no real specific reason as to why that was chosen.
Questions from committee members. Mr. Witt, under A and B, those are criteria that two of the criteria that is called out in the federal guidance document that you provided, and the third was the GPS of the crop. And so I'm wondering if it needs to be here or not. And again, it's a purely technical question for consistency with the guidance that you provided us in the committee document. Does that need to be there, or is it fine that it doesn't have the location of the crop?
Yes, Madam Chair, you're speaking specifically of the GPS locations of the grower, and the Division of Agriculture will have that information in their records. So we did not include that in this piece. We wanted to specifically include the name of the grower, the location of their business address, and really the amount of industrial hemp that they have produced, transferred. We thought that would suffice, that the GPS record would be with the Division of Agriculture. It wouldn't be a I don't believe it would be a bad idea to include that, because if the record is retained for 3 years and the GPS location from the farmer is different from the GPS location of the registration that the Division of Agriculture has, it would certainly raise some questions. So I believe the bill sponsor would be open to including that in this section.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? On line 29 on page 4, and again on the top of page 5, line 1, in reference to fees collected that equal the regulatory costs of regulating this proposed new industry, I'm wondering why the word approximate was used. We did have two individuals testify with concern about any cost of the program, and other licensures inside of state government for professional licensing, we require them to pay for the cost of the program support, and we don't use the word approximately. We actually confine them to a fee that actually supports the cost. And so I'm just questioning the use of the word approximately.
Yes, Madam Chair. The reason we chose to use the word approximate is because this is a new endeavor for the state. The fees associated with the registration will be charged prior to the crop actually being grown. At this point, since the crop isn't being grown, there's no way to know exactly to the penny what the regulatory costs are going to be associated with the crop. That's my best explanation for the use of that word. Again, it's a pilot program. And as we learn more about costs associated with regulation, the Division of Agriculture may be able to take that word away and be very specific with what it's going to cost per acre, per square foot, per ton of hemp that is grown, whatever their calculation for measurement may be.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. On page 5, line 10, under E, it says the department may issue a stop order and issue a violation or may adopt regulation regarding approval of shipping documents. It goes on to conduct random tests and inspections. Does may or shall cause an increase in the fiscal note? Do you know? And is there a reason that we're not requiring a violation to be issued if there is a problem with someone who would enter into this new industry?
Madam Chair, Rob Carter has told me he would again be available to join us. He might be able to add to this, but I'd say the Division of Agriculture, they may want to use, for lack of a better term, some leniency at the beginning and being able to review the crop and make a determination if a stop sale or a violation is the appropriate measure for proceeding with a specific registered grower. Beyond that, I would say Rob Carter could give us more insight on that answer.
Mr. Carter, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair.
If you could identify yourself for the record and then please provide the committee with insight on the may or shall.
For the record, this is Rob Carter for the Division of Ag. It is language by the bill sponsor, but the interpretation by the division when reading the may or shall, we currently offer or issue a stop sale order for a violation of a regulation, if the incumbent of that stop sale order does not follow that order, then the violation, which is the civil penalty and a Class B misdemeanor, then is allocated to that individual. If the stop sale order is issued at that point, and in this case registrant of the industrial hemp program complies, there is no violation. And I think that is the determining thing from the determining factor, or the definition between may and shall. If we say shall, that means if we offer a stop sale, we immediately have to offer a violation. and that's unnecessary if the individual is complying with the stop sale order. To move on to 2 and 3, where adopt regulations for regarding approved shipping and documentation. This is something that came in with concerns from the Marijuana Control Board and DPS with questions about what would they do if they saw a truck full of marijuana driving down the street. And we looked at saying, hey, well, would this suffice if we created documentation for these individuals to carry with them? Again, it's not in the federal guidance, and that's where that may shall come in or comes in over shall.
Mr. Carter, if you could go down then to F on line 19. It goes back to the question I asked earlier in the morning meeting. On F on the second line, line 19, it says, may import into the state and resell industrial hemp seeds. And again, the guidance said specifically that DEA would have to be involved in the shipment from another state. So can you speak to that again?
For the record, this is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag. Madam Chair, that is correct. The guidance provided in there that the DEA would have to issue, and I believe it is correct, a Form 225, which is basically the transfer of a controlled substance for research or marketing purposes. A registrant of our program, of this program, could then in turn apply through the DEA to in turn import seeds and then recoup the cost of those to another registrant of the program.
Thank you. Mr. Carter, do you have a comment on $500? Is that consistent with other places in code for a violation? It's on line 27. It's the only place that I see a violation and a fee associated with this this industry, so it appears that $500 is a maximum violation. Mr. Witt, did you have a comment on that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Hughes. There is currently in statute, Alaska Statute 0305090, under the Division of Agriculture, that the Division of Agriculture actually has the authority to issue a penalty, a civil penalty of up to $500 for farmers who are not following guidelines that the Division of Agriculture has set up. There's additional provision that they can take it as far as a Class A misdemeanor, should they continue. So we were trying to match that language and that authority that it's already set up in statute when putting together the civil penalties and other penalties that would be enacted should someone not follow the rules. We are, again, trying to keep this under the Division of Agriculture's purview as often as possible. So the bill sponsor believed that it was important to still keep those penalties under the Division of Agriculture by the authority already set.
Mr. Witt, do you believe that $500 is a deterrent if the TC content or much higher? The product looks identical to marijuana that requires a license and much more closer monitoring of each individual plant and what the plant produces versus a field for harvest. Is there is $500 a deterrent?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure it would be a deterrent to me, certainly, but the Division of Agriculture has the authority to fine $500 as often as they need to. That could be multiple times. I would also say that we're talking about a crop that, within the bill as presented, we're talking about a THC content of 0.3. Above 1.0, it actually becomes, we start talking about criminal violations. And we talk about some very serious criminal violations when it comes to having 20 acres of a crop that is above 1% THC. It'd be very serious. So it's incumbent upon the registered grower to pay very close attention and to be corrected and get in line before they get in very serious criminal issues.
Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, do we have a resident expert online here that can talk to us about industrial hemp versus the other kind of pot?
Mr. Carter, are you a residential expert that we could draw on for the difference between pot and
hemp?
Hemp?
And I'll
industrial hemp.
Madam Chair, this is Rob Carter for the record, the Division of Ag. I more than likely can probably answer most of your questions, I believe.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. So I was told, and I haven't Googled it, but that hemp grows in excess of 4 feet, 5 feet, 6 feet tall, and you're in the stuff that's sold in the retail store for human consumption doesn't grow that big. And I understand that the leaf is the same, but the hemp has no buds on it, and the fiber in this its stalk and the fiber is different. So is that a fairy tale, or is that close to being accurate, or what?
Mr. Carter.
This is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I think you have some correct information there, and I think you have some that is maybe just needs to be redirected. The planting densities are what deter the phenotypical trait differences between these, are the physical traits of hemp, industrial hemp being upright, where recreational marijuana in that realm is grown in most cases to be a larger, wider plant to create flowers, because that is probably the most useful part of those plants, even though they are, the leaf and other parts are also utilized for that industry. I think the largest difference between industrial hemp and the recreational marijuana world is that the recreational individuals are growing cannabis sativa for their flowers, which, and then the byproducts of those plants, which are females. In the industrial hemp industry, they are growing male and female plants in one setting. So there is pollination, there is seed development. So the biggest difference is, one, you could say that, for a lack of better terms, the recreational industry grows female plants, and the industrial hemp industry grows both male and female for seed production.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you for the follow-up. So talk to me about somebody genetically has done something in a lab for the seeds for industrial hemp, so that I would think that because the THC content is 0.3%.
Mr. Carter, do you know if the seeds have been modified?
For the record, this is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, to the best of my knowledge and the research that I have done around the world, industrial hemp has not been modified in a laboratory. In fact, I would be shocked to see if anyone invested that type of money in an industrial or an agricultural crop that was illegal in majority of the states. It has been a natural selection process over time, utilizing those old landrace strains that have been around since the 30s that were used for the original industrial hemp revolution that happened. They've identified those, they've collected those through other agencies, and then through a traditional breeding program, they have selected cultivars or varieties of industrial hemp that hold true and reproduce naturally that ability to keep their THC at roughly 0.3%.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continuing on line 25, could you describe what cannabidiol oil is? It's on the last two words of the sentence. So we're saying hash and hashish oil have the meaning given in 1171.900, but does not include, and I can't say it accurately, Mr. DeWitt.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's cannabidiol oil or CBD oil. CBD oil, you can actually, if you wanted to, go to a Walmart, Walgreens, and buy CBD oil. You can get it at Rainbow Foods if you wanted to. CBD oil is, the best way that I can explain it is, as THC increases, the CBD content decreases. So when you naturally, when you're growing an industrial hemp plant at 0.3% THC or lower, your CBD content is much higher than your THC content. There's, as an industry, they're still experimenting with CBD, trying to find out what kind of medicinal effects there may be for it. Some people take it as a as part of their daily health or vitamin intake. It's been used for several different things. As far as the chemical compound of it itself, I couldn't tell you exactly what it is, but I can tell you that the intent language here is that the CBD oil, first of all, is very low THC. It would be under the 0.3% THC as defined in by industrial hemp, and would have no no effects of a high THC content. That might not answer your question, ma'am. I'll see if Mr. Carter can add anything to it.
Mr. Witt, I'll just take your definition. It's oil. It's available. It would be marked so that people, the general population, would know if it was sold or how would it be used. We're exempting it, so we're going to produce it. You're allowing someone to produce it.
Yes, Madam Chair. CBD oil is the oil content of industrial hemp that is used in products like lotions, soaps, candles, numerous number of products. In fact, one of the staffers for a member of this committee brought me by some hand lotion today that had hemp oil in it, and that is CBD oil. It's the byproduct, the liquid byproduct from industrial hemp that's used for numerous products. This is just the chemical name of it, CBD oil or cannabidiol.
That clarifies the record. Thank you. Questions from committee members? Moving on to page 6, line 8. Is there a reason that you chose the word peace officer instead of law enforcement?
Madam Chair, it's just to match current statute was my belief by the drafter.
Thank you. Moving on to section 5. Please proceed with your sectional analysis.
Yes, ma'am. Section 5, page 6, lines 21 through 23, the definition of industrial hemp. This definition meets the federal statute, as mentioned before. Industrial hemp is the plant Cannabis sativa L containing less than 0.3% delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC. Section 6, same page, lines 24 through 31, and then continue on page 7, lines 1 and 2. This is amendment in statute to remove industrial hemp, as defined in the previous section, from the list of controlled substances. Section 7, page 7, lines 3 through 5. Food containing industrial hemp, as defined in the section AS0305-100, is not considered adulterated.
If we could pause there for a moment.
Ma'am.
Mr. Witt, how do we regulate food and consumption to make sure that Alaskans are protected if oils or some other part of the product is being used in something, flour, I think I saw an example of, or other products? If it's unadulterated, if it has industrial hemp in it, who is protecting the people of Alaska, or is it buyer beware?
Yes, Madam Chair. My understanding from an answer that I received from Mr. Rob Carter is that DEC actually regulates food. The Division of Agriculture does not. I have not had time to research that further, and if the Chair wishes, I'd be happy to get further information for the committee.
Thank you. If I could go to Mr. Carter. Mr. Carter, do you have any information that you could provide the committee on sources of industrial hemp being put into the food supply in Alaska?
Could you repeat the question, Madam Chair?
Certainly. Under Section 7, on page 7, lines 4 through 5, we amend Alaska State Statute to allow a hemp product to be used for food. In other words, it says food is not adulterated under this section solely because it contains industrial hemp, and then hemp is defined in AS03-05.100. So I'm asking, how do we protect Alaskans? How do we know that pesticides aren't in the product for flour? How do we know that something that might harm humans in oil goes in? And Mr. Witt suggested that DEC regulates food in Alaska. As I understand it, you regulate a whole product, like a carrot or some other farming item, some other crop, but not necessarily the products that the crops make.
For the record, this is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag. Madam Chair, you are correct there. It is in the processed products are regulated by the Department of Environmental Conservation. In the case that the Division of Ag regulates raw agricultural products. I don't think that food that's been adulterated would be deemed a raw agricultural product. I think for your concern about pesticides maybe being transferred to a food product, the one nice thing about industrial hemp is it requires almost no pesticides. And to reassure that, with the lack of research and development by pesticide companies around the nation, there are currently no pesticides registered for use on industrial hemp. So if someone is spraying pesticides on industrial hemp, they're breaking the federal law. In second to that, I believe that the intent behind this language is because the genus Cannabis sativa L is deemed as a Schedule I narcotic, if someone in Alaska was putting that into a product similar to what you buy a hemp seed granola bar currently at the store that's coming from somewhere else, here within the state of Alaska, we wouldn't be holding our food producers or processors or manufacturers to a different standard than we're already holding and allowing hemp food to be shipped into the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Mr. Witt, I'd like to hear from DEC to understand how they regulate the product. You provided us a very useful fact sheet that there are a variety of foods that it could be used in a variety of ways to change the product. It's showing cakes and pizzas or donuts, flour, hemp oil can be fuel or cooking oil. Cake can be beer or fed to animals. And then we go into fiber and other ways that it can be used. So if we could hear from DEC on how they might manage that. Please continue with your sectional.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Section 8.
Thank you. Section 8, page 7, lines 6 through 14. Again, we're amending Alaska Statute 1738-900 in order to exclude industrial hemp as defined in this bill from the definition of marijuana. And finally, Section 9, page 7, lines 15 through 30, we are directing the Department of Natural Resources Division of Agriculture to submit a report to the legislature on the program, the industrial hemp program, by December 1st of 2024. And that is the end of the bill, ma'am.
Is there any questions on the structure of the bill before us? Senator Dunleavy.
I don't have a question, Madam Chair, on the structure of the bill. I will have a question later.
Thank you. My last question, Mr. Witt. Currently, under federal law, hemp is in a controlled substance, and I believe that this bill removes industrial hemp from a controlled substance, and I don't, because we've had two meetings, I don't recall if we've taken up that issue.
Madam Chair, if I might, Madam Chair, Ms. Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, Criminal Division has joined us in the room today. She may be able to shed some light on how the federal law and what we're trying to do here in the state, how it communicates.
Certainly. Ms. Schroeder, if you're prepared today, if you could identify yourself for the record and then provide the committee with any comments you might have regarding the controlled substance at a federal level. I do understand Alaskans have voted to legalize marijuana, so if you could just help walk us through the legality of what's happening here versus the guidelines that I've read from the federal government.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Madam Chair, you are correct that marijuana is a Schedule I controlled substance under federal law. However, I believe that the farm bill that Mr. Witt has previously mentioned does specifically talk about producing hemp if the THC content is below 0.3%. So there is an allowance made there.
Ms. Schroeder, I'll have to re-look at this, but I believe it still says that it's a controlled substance.
Madam Chair, are you looking at the bill?
No, I'm looking at the notice of guidance, and I believe, I'd have to reread the, I've highlighted quite a bit, so I can't get to it quickly on. It's in the second column over two-thirds of the way down. Under the paragraph that starts section 7606 in the center column, and then if you go to the bottom sentence, it says section 7606 did not remove industrial hemp from the controlled substance list. Therefore, federal law continues to restrict hemp activities to the extent that those activities have not been legalized under 7606.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I'm not very familiar with the Farm Bill. That is an agricultural bill and outside of the criminal context, but it seems that that language is saying that if you are following Section 7606, then that would be an allowable conduct with industrial hemp. And Mr. Carter is more familiar with that law. He may have something to add there.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Mr. Carter, do you have any comments on the controlled substance issue?
Madam Chair, you are correct. Section 706 of the Farm Bill did not remove industrial hemp from the National Controlled Substance Act, but it did give legal by proxy to the activities that are authorized underneath the industrial hemp pilot program. The language here in removing it from the state of Alaska is kind of to protect the agricultural industry. The last thing that we want to see is an agricultural producer get stuck in prison when his only intent was to produce an agricultural crop and make a living.
Mr. Carter, I believe in the previous legislative session after the legalization of marijuana initiative passed, that the bill that we instituted did not take marijuana off the controlled substance list for the state of Alaska. So hemp then would be seen differently in Alaska than at least the past legislative vote. Ms. Schroeder?
Madam Chair, you are correct. Without this change in the bill, hemp would fall under the definition of marijuana, both in Title 11 and Title 17, and would be subject to those restrictions and regulations.
Thank you. Any additional questions? I understand.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
I guess it spills over into the marijuana thing. What are the restrictions we have in marijuana in the state of Alaska? Thank you.
It's a circular argument, Senator Dunleavy.
Well, I'm just saying, it's just more of a, you don't have to answer that, but it's just more of a comment. And I understand the hemp issue is getting more scrutiny than marijuana. My understanding is you can grow your own, mix your own, make your own cookies, brownies, little cookie men, whatever. And there's no
lollipops,
drinks, whatever you want to do, right? Is that correct in Alaska right now, even though it's a controlled substance? Am I wrong?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. For personal use, people can do most of those things if they're operating with an ounce or less, or if they have 12 plants within a dwelling, no matter how many people live there. So those are the restrictions as far as doing those types of activities with marijuana. If you are operating outside of that and you do not have a license, for instance, if you are selling marijuana, and you do not have a license, the criminal code would kick in.
State criminal code?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might,
Mr. Witt,
add that Senator Dunleavy does make a very good point. This bill has been under a lot of scrutiny. It's gone through this process. We are trying to do it the right way. I can't speak for other bills having to do with cannabis sativa L, but I can speak for the bill sponsor when I say that we want to make sure this is done the right way, the public interest is protected, and serious farmers who want to grow a large biomass for industrial hemp are protected when they're doing things right, and that there are consequences for when they do things wrong. I can't speak for everything else, but I believe that the federal provisions for industrial hemp combined with this bill and the protections that we're trying to put in place make way for a possible new agricultural product in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. The finer point that I was trying to draw your attention to is that under the marijuana discussion from the voter initiative, that a past legislative body had not taken marijuana off the controlled list. And there was a purpose for that during those debates, and that was that it was still listed as a controlled substance at a federal level, and we didn't want to create a false expectation if you tried to enter a federal property or an airline that the people wouldn't understand that the federal law could kick in. And so there was that debate in our bodies about what should be legalized and what shouldn't be legalized. But I understand the intent of this legislation. Senator Machicki.
I just have a question for the Department of Law. Would a better analogy between hemp and recreational marijuana sort of be the difference between a grape and wine?
Ms. Schroeder, identify yourself for the record.
This is Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. I would not want to comment on that analogy.
Pardon?
I would not comment on that analogy.
Okay. I'll put it another way. In the women's restroom right now, there is hemp soap.
How would you know what's in the women's restroom?
I have three female staff members, but there's hemp soap. So at what point can hemp be transported across state lines when it's in the form of a product?
Madam Chair, that might be a question for Mr. Carter.
Mr. Carter, do you have a brief comment on what's to make for Senator Machicki?
This is Rob Carter for the record. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, if it's a hemp seed, once it's deemed inviable, cannot grow, then it can be sold and transported. Any non-raw agricultural product, once it is met a processing or a processed product, turned into soap for the ladies' bathroom in Juneau, it can then be transported worldwide.
Thank you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you.
Any further comments on understanding the structure of the bill?
Madam Chair, if I might, again, Buddy Witt with staff Senator Hughes. In speaking with the Department of Law about this bill in preparation for this hearing, the Department of Law did point out one area that I'd like the committee to consider. If the committee members have read numerous news stories recently, the state of Alaska and the Marijuana Control Board has been confiscated CBD oils in many places around the state. As I explained CBD oil earlier, if the committee felt it necessary, on page 5, lines 21 through 25, where the bill specifically talks about hashish and hashish oil, but as defined in AS 1171-900, but not to include cannabidiol oil or CBD oil, an order to remove CBD oil from the criminal code to avoid confiscation of CBD oil in the future, we would actually need to exclude CBD oil from AS 1171-900, where it speaks to hashish oil. Just mentioning that, it would be the bill sponsor believes it might save the state some money if they didn't have to go out and spend money to confiscate CBD oil, which has little to no THC content. And with that, that is the only statement that the bill sponsor asked me to make in reference to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. If we could, I'd like to go over the fiscal note. Senator Bishop, Ms. Schroeder, thank you. Mr. Witt, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your bill packet, all existing fiscal notes, there are four, and they include four zeros. Those are for the Department of Public Safety, Department of Law, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and Department of Public Safety. There is one fiscal note, Department of Natural Resources. The appropriation is agriculture. Allocation is Northern Latitude Plant Materials Center. The OMB component number is 2204. That's for $25,000 in UGF. It's indeterminate in revenues. Bill analysis quickly is this bill requires the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to adopt regs and conduct oversight of industrial hemp in Alaska. DNR would enter into a reimbursable service agreement with the Department of Law to assist in drafting regulations at a cost of approximately $25,000. The cost of administering the registration program would be determined after regulations are drafted. And those costs will be recovered via revenue from approximately 25 farms the department anticipates to register within the first year, ma'am.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. There is $25,000 worth of UGF on this fiscal note, so we will work with the department to better understand the rationale that is very sparse on page 2 of why they need $25,000 to draft these regulations. I believe their assertion is that they will need expertise that they will have to contract out with and that they will need to advance UGF in that number. With that, I'd like to set this bill aside. Amendments, again, to the bill are due Wednesday at 5 p.m. Brief at ease.
Call the meeting back to order. Senate Bill 31 is before us. We have previously heard the bill. We took open and closed public testimony and reviewed physical notes. I'm going to ask Department of Administration to come up, and whoever you'd like to come up, either Leslie or Kate, if you guys both want to come up and tag team. There was some questions that were asked, and if you'd just like to walk us through your response, it would be greatly appreciated. Welcome to the committee this afternoon, and thanks for coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Leslie Rydell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration.
And for the record, my name is Kate Sheehan. I'm Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations.
Please proceed. We've got, I believe all our members have the Q's and A's in their bill packets, and we're ready for you just to walk us through those, please.
Great. Thank you. Actually, I'm going to ask Kate Sheehan to walk you through. She helped develop most of the charts, so ask her to do that.
Very good.
All right. Thank you. These are based upon questions we received at the prior hearing we had on Senate Bill 31. The first question was how long it would take an employee to get to the end of the alphabet. Our pay increments are, of course, A steps and above. And it would take approximately 39 years, assuming that an employee never promoted, demoted, and just stayed at the same position in the same range.
Thank you.
The second question was how long it would take to double an employee's salary, their initial salary. It would take approximately 37 to 40 years, but that's assuming, again, that they stayed in the same position at the same range their entire career and that the state never provided for a cost of living allowance. We then made some assumptions that if there were cost of living allowances of approximately 1%, they could actually double the initial salary in 23 to 24 years. Then we made another assumption if there was a cost of living allowance of 1.33%, and really that's just to kind of mimic what a 1% COLA, 1% COLA, and 2% COLA would look like over a three-year agreement, for instance, or legislation, that then the initial salary could be doubled in approximately 20 to 21 years.
Okay.
We then had a question what the attrition rate is for non-covered employees, and we have provided a report titled Copy of EX Employees and PX Separation Rates. And for 2015, it was approximately 19.5%. For fiscal year 2016, it was approximately 13.7%.
Thank you.
The next question we received is the total salary cost for non-covered employees. And so we've kind of put that into two separate things. So the payroll of the non-covered employees who are included in this bill is approximately $370 million. That includes the university, but it excludes the legislature, courts, and Alaska Marine Highways. Alaska Marine Highways are not subject to this legislation. They are exempt employees, but they are covered by collective bargaining. The next question kind of follows up on that, and it's the total of personal services for the state. For that, it is $1.8 billion, which excludes the university, legislature, courts, and again, marine highways. Salaries of all state employees is $2.4 billion.
Okay, questions, anybody, committee? Good. All right, continue on, please.
The next question was the number of employees at each range and each step. So we have provided a report titled Copy of XE Employee Counts, and you can see what we've done is we've just taken every range and then every step and listed how many employees are there. There are a couple of strange things. You'll see the term inapplicable and then a zero range. We've used the term inapplicable because there are some employees who are not paid on a salary schedule. For instance, commissioners, their salary set by the State Officers Compensation Commission. Where you see a range zero is because there are certain types of employees that don't necessarily have a range. For instance, our substitute teachers at the Vocational Technical Center and at the Mount Edgecombe, they're not assigned a range. They are provided a daily rate. So that kind of explains some of the zero ranges you see. Otherwise, our salary schedule really starts at a range six.
Okay. Senator Dunleavy.
Quick at ease.
Quick at ease. Brief at ease. On the record, Senator Dunleavy, you have a question?
Yes, through the chair. Just a quick question. When we're looking at 3927.0 or .011K, this allows the governor to hire beyond step F if he makes the written determination of extraordinary need. However, there appears to be no restriction on hiring at steps A through E. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the personnel rules govern if you can be hired above A step, and so you could be hired above A step all the way up to F step if there are exceptional qualifications and or recruitment difficulties, and that is governed by the personnel rules.
Through the chair.
Follow up.
So he doesn't need to meet, does he or does he not need to make a written determination for A through E?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, not for A through E, but anything at a pay increment, which is J or higher, would need a written determination.
So it's correct me if I'm wrong, it's still a salary override, but he doesn't need to do a written explanation for A through E.
Through the chair, the governor wouldn't have to, the appointing authority would have to show that there were recruitment difficulties and or exceptional qualifications.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Okay, next.
Right, the next question that I'm on is number seven, and that was we were asked for the number of non-covered employees on salary overrides and advanced step placement. So I think I explained it a little bit last time, but I'll go through it again. We've attached three different reports. There's an executive branch employees with rate overrides, and there's a part one and a part two just because it's a long report. These are essentially employees that we're not paying based on a salary schedule, and there's various reasons why that may be. When you go through the report, you'll see we have a lot of state troopers who are paid on a salary override. And the reason that is when a state trooper, under the terms of their collective bargaining agreement, are acting as investigators, they get paid a range higher. But then when they're no longer acting as an investigator, they go back down to the state trooper range. So we don't put them on a new salary schedule. We don't want to confuse it. So we just pay them on a salary override. So we have many employees who we pay that way for various reasons, classified employees and non-covered employees. The second report is titled Executive Branch Exempt and Partially Exempt Employees Hired from January 1st, 2015 to December 31st, 2016 at an advanced step. And what this chart is reflecting is what we did is we went in and we pulled the hire date of partially exempt and exempt employees, and then we looked at if they were hired above a step A. So we have 118 employees listed on this chart. They have a hire date, but they were brought in at above step A, various steps. So what we've done here is we've listed the department, the position, and then what range and step they were hired at. In order to determine why they were hired at a step, we will have to go in and look at every individual. A lot of these employees had already earned that step, meaning maybe they had been a division director before and had earned D-step. When they come back under our rules, they can be hired at D-step. Some of these were also appointed at a higher step through the process and the personnel rules, which again is exceptional qualifications or recruitment difficulty. And I know there is one on here who was appointed through the governor's, through 3927.011K exception. So at this point, we haven't had time to go look up each individual, but we can do that, and I believe I can have that for you in approximately 3 to 5 days.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure. This contains the salary overrides?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
How many would you estimate are in this packet?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, there's over 2,000.
Salary overrides.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Please continue.
All right. The final question, the committee requested to know the number of hires since the hiring restriction went into effect in January 2016. And so we have attached a report titled State Employment Statistics for 2016. And approximately we have employees reduced during the hiring freeze is 804.
Could you repeat that again, please, for me?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The last report is State Employee Statistics for 2016. That's the title of the report. And when you look at the total number of employees that have left state service and then the number that we've replaced them with, you will see that we are down 804 employees, although we are down 2,500 positions. And you'll see the second page of the report will draw your attention to the Department of Labor statistics.
I have just one follow-up, Senator, before I get to your question, please. And what, refresh my memory on what departments are exempt from the hiring freeze.
Mr. Chair,
And if you don't have it right now, that's fine. You can get back to committee. We got a lot of stuff going on.
Let me get back to you. It's a hiring restriction, and so I will have to look to see if there were any agencies that were exempted from it.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy followed up, and Senator Von Imhoff.
So is it a restriction or freeze? Because you keep using the terms interchangeably.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I apologize. It is a restriction. We are hiring people.
That's not a hard freeze. We're still hiring people.
Correct.
Thank you.
And that's just a follow-up. That's the point I'm trying to make, because there's obviously some exempt positions, I mean, that are, you know, outside of that hard deadline of a freeze. So, Senator Von Imhoff, please.
So going back to your comment of decrease of 804 employees, but then again you said in the second page overall state employees have decreased by 2,500 people. Can you please marry up those two comments and how they relate? Because they don't equal in my mind, but how do they relate to one another, please?
Through the chair, Senator, I will have to get back to you. These are numbers that were put together by OMB, and I will need to verify with them.
Okay.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, as you're doing that, when you say people, can you define that further when you get back to us? Is that an FTE? Is that a temp? Is that a year-round? Is it what does the 2,500 constitute? Is it 2,500 full-time year-round FTEs? Because that's one thing. Or is it 2,500 partials temporary? Is it, what is it exactly? And that 2,500 figure, if you could break that down, that'd be good. Thanks.
Senator Dunleavy, if I might follow up, are you requesting by department when you ask that breakdown? Thank you. Any further questions at this point? If not, I think I'll have the Ms. Lucky come to the table and explain some changes to a fiscal note, please. Thank you, ladies.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Julie Luckey. I'm staff to Senator Anna McKinnon. There were some questions about the when Senate Bill 31 came to us, there was one fiscal note for all executive departments. There was some confusion about what was included in that fiscal note. The fiscal note has been replaced with a new executive department fiscal note. I will note that the numbers are the same in the fiscal note for both FY18 excuse me, and FY19, but the narrative is different. Just to clarify, and if you look on page 2, they put in a chart, the executive branch, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, University of Alaska are all covered in the bill and all included in the current fiscal note. The Permanent Fund Corporation is covered by the bill but was not included in the fiscal note. The judicial branch is not covered by the bill and therefore is not included in the fiscal note. And the legislative branch is covered by the bill and is not included in the executive branch fiscal note. Just to reiterate, the estimated savings is $4,165,600 over two fiscal years. There is an, excuse me, the total FY18 reduction is $2,269,500. Senator Hoffman had asked for a little bit of clarification on the permanent fund and how it was affected. The permanent fund did come up with a fiscal note, and you should have received it today in your packets. They have a zero fiscal note, but they do talk about their impacts on the second page. And you can read for the narrative for yourself, but they do say that the funding for APFC salary increases is not automatic. Personal services increments, including any adjustments in recognition for high-performing teams, are brought forward to the Board of Trustees for consideration, and if approved, then forwarded to the governor and the legislature for consideration in the operating budget. So that's how therefore they have a zero fiscal note because their merit increases are handled in a different way. They do discuss a little bit more about their impact, so I encourage you to read the second page of that fiscal note if you're interested in understanding more about the impacts to APFC. The legislative branch did forward an indeterminate fiscal note that was reviewed at the last meeting. I'm not sure if there are any questions about that, but there is a breakdown of the legislative fiscal note on page 2. I believe that was covered in the last meeting. I do believe if there are questions on the OMB numbers or any of the narrative, there is a representative from OMB here to discuss any questions.
Seeing none, I have one. Thank you, Julie. Ms. Luckey, you're done. I have one quick question for Kate Sheehan, if you please come back. For these employees in question in this bill, did they receive a pay freeze or a pay cut to date? Or is this the first attempt to lower their wages in the last 4 years?
For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan, Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Mr. Chairman, we have not to date imposed a freeze on merit increases or pay increments. However, this administration has not given any cost of living allowances.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions, committee members? Seeing none, thank you. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Any closing comments from committee members? Because we're going to hold this bill over. Seeing none, we're adjourned.